Good morning. We're going to call to order the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division. And we do have a quorum. So we've got minutes from March 5th. Representative Brand.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for the March 5th meeting.
All right. Any discussions, additions, corrections? I don't see any. All in favor of the minutes being adopted, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We will have three bills today. Then we're going to also do a walkthrough of the MDA policy bill. And for the most part, I think we're laying bills over, except Representative Lippert has one that will be moving on to another committee. And before, as Representative Lippert, please join us at the testimony table. And I just wanted to say that we don't have any students yet in our midst, but we have lots of people here. So that's good. We're going to maybe make an announcement in a little bit about some students. So they're not here yet. Sure. Oh. Okay, I'm sorry. I kind of came in late today, so I apologize. Okay, so Representative Lippert, you have a bill, and you'd like to move that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 3558 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
All right. And you also have an author's amendment.
Yes, I move that the A1 amendment, and can explain it quickly. So this bill is a response to the Emerging Farmer Report and seeks to implement some of the recommendations of that report. The amendment has two parts. One advances is just related to the ability to access grant funds earlier in the process, and then the second part continues the work of the task force, the Emerging Farmer Task Force.
All right. Are there any questions to the author's amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. That motion prevails. So that is now the bill before us, 3558, as amended. So Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So a few weeks ago, we had the presentation of the Emerging Farmer Task Force, and we had some young farmers who were part of that conversation and testimony. And one of the recommendations that they put forward was to increase the microloan amount from $10,000 to $20,000, which is the heart of this bill. In conversation with the Department of Agriculture, that microloan program is part of the MDA's revolving loan account, which is about $4.3 million. The MDA has done 10 microloans for $88,000 since the program began in 2012, but it did do six of those in 2019. I just bring this up because it suggests that this we're not in danger of limiting the number of farmers that can access those important funds, but the purpose of this is to allow emerging farmers to be able to access more capital. And that's really the purpose of the amendment as well, is to get those grant funds to farmers earlier. So the MDA suggested that the advancement of a 50% of a grant to certain applicants and no longer including the low-income eligibility category used in USDA's EQIP program. So that's an overview of the bill and the amendment, and I can invite Gary Werdish to come forward on behalf of Minnesota Farmers Union at this time, too.
Thank you. So you have the testifier. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Werdish, and just state your name and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Poppy and the committee. Gary Werdish, President of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I also sit on the RFA, Rural Finance Authority Board, which this microloan program is administered through. Right now, there's challenging times in agriculture. There's no doubt about that. And the amount of capital required is really a hurdle for especially emerging farmers to access. $10,000 sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. In the world of agriculture, it's not. Whether you're starting a farm or whether specialty crops or buying some livestock, it doesn't go very far. The whole purpose of this program, this loan, is to help another group of farmers get started farming. You know, hopefully at some point get them started. It starts them at a small level, and maybe they can work into full-time farmers. But if not, at least get some on the ground and has another economic activity out there. You know, we had one of our members testified earlier in the committee, or one of the committee hearings, Rachel Santa Road. She has access, and it's helped her get started. So it's pretty straightforward, Bill, and we definitely support it and encourage you to move it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Wartish. Any questions? Yes, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lippert, if you could just expand my understanding of one of the qualifications as a qualified non-citizen. It seems pretty straightforward, but a person admitted to the United States for lawful permanent resident or as a refugee. What's a lawful permanent resident status? What would be some of the examples of that?
Representative Lippert.
I'm wondering if House Research might have some be able to help with that question.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, I can't answer that specific question. I do know that the language that's incorporated on lines 1.10 of the amendment, the qualified non-citizen language, is the eligibility criteria used under current law for the microloan program. And a person admitted to the United States for lawful resident, permanent residence, or as a refugee, those are two of the criteria or eligibility or definitions, really, of a qualified non-citizen. I can grab the full list and read it to the committee if that would be helpful. But to your specific question, I don't know enough about immigration law to give folks a good answer on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Sullivan, if you could clarify, because the way that I just heard it was you said this is already in statute for microloans, and yet it's an underlined section, so that's an addition. Too. So I don't want to badger this down deep, so I don't really have to pull out a book and give me the long list of it. I kind of heard two things there. I see that it's an addition to law, and yet you said it's already in this law. So can you kind of clarify that for me?
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Miller. Yeah, I didn't explain that particularly well. The bill as amended now would impact both the microloan program, which is in current law, and it would add this new section in the amendment that applies not to the microloan program, but to any grant program administered by the department. So what I meant to say was that the qualified non-citizen language that would now apply to language encouraging the department to award grants to recipients on an advance payment basis rather than a reimbursement basis, that same criteria or same definition of an eligible entity for purposes of advance payment of grants would be the qualified non-citizen language that's in current law, one of the eligibility criteria for the microloan program.
Okay, thank you.
All right, other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This comment, or I guess question, isn't necessarily about this bill, although it does mention in the amendment somebody new to farming for 10 years or less. And I think we've all heard from folks that come in and say their son or daughter has been in 4-H in high school, for example, and because they sold a cow or a calf or something, they had to file a Schedule F on the tax return. And that counts then on their 10 years of farming. And it may be something we could look at in the future, that changing this definition to allow somebody who was in 4-H and sold a few livestock to not have those years count in that definition of farming, because it does make a difference. They hit up to that 10 years and pretty quickly if they filed 3 or 4 tax returns in high school, for example.
That's a valid point. Thank you. Anyone else have questions? Okay, anyone else who wants to testify in support or opposition on this bill? Okay, then Representative Lippert.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 3558 is amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill will be advancing its way to government operations. All right. So, Representative Wasilewicz. This is related to House File 4003, and it is in your packet. You may begin. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a bill, actually, I'll just, so this is a bill of Representative Wasilewicz that will move House File 4003 to be laid over for future consideration. So
thank you, Madam Chair. I will make that motion to lay House File 4003 over for possible inclusion. Just want to give a brief introduction to the bill here. As members have heard in this committee and probably from folks around the state, small and mid-scale livestock farmers in many regions of our state are facing shortages of meat processors. For farmers who do have access to processing, they're facing long wait times, long transport distances, or lack of equal to or USDA certification, which can cut into farmers' bottom lines. The factors contributing to the lack of meat processing vary and are often interrelated across the state. And these include challenges related to workforce, skilled training, generational transitions of processors, and challenges with regulatory compliance. This bill is one way that we're attempting to get more information to help solve this problem. It calls on the Department of Agriculture to convene a group of farmers, processors, and agency staff in order to dig into these challenges and develop recommendations for the committee's next session. The bill also requires the commissioner to give special attention to the potential environmental benefits of grazing livestock. Increasing access to meat processing for farmers who graze livestock could increase the profitability of grazing operations and also have a positive impact on climate as grazed pasturelands help keep carbon fixed under the soil. So that's the bill we're looking at today. It's an appropriation for $10,000 to have this group and then to have a report issued to the legislature so we have a better understanding of the issues that are being faced and can hopefully take some action.
Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. And I know you have a testifier, I believe Josh Vanderpool. So welcome to the committee. And just if you first state your name and then give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Poppe and members of the committee for allowing me time to come and talk about meat processing, an issue very important to our farm and business. For the record, my name is Josh Vanderpool. I'm from Kirkhoven, Minnesota. I'm here with my wife, Cindy, and together we raise farrow to finish hogs, free-range laying hens, beef cattle, which we graze seasonally in western Minnesota. Some of you may have seen our pork products as they're available at food co-ops around the state, including several in the Twin Cities area. We also have redesigned our website to improve our sales direct to customers, both through our delivery network and our on-farm store. We began farming in 1996 with hogs as our main enterprise. Market crash shortly after left us with hog prices as low as 8 cents a pound. The State Equal Two program was just getting started at that point. We saw an opportunity to market direct to the consumer and avoid the instability of the commodity markets. As a mid-sized livestock farm supporting three generations, we rely on meat processors to be able to bring our livestock to market. Unfortunately, as an executive committee member of Minnesota Farmers Union, I hear from farmers who've lost their processor. I also hear from processors who are leaving the business. This affects young farmers who want to start out with a small herd, folks transitioning out of dairy and into beef cattle, and those seeking to graze their animals to promote soil health. I've heard stories from some of our members. One of our members has to deal with a three-hour trip one way to get his poultry inspected. Another one had a lot of trouble this last fall trying to get their hogs processed. They ended up with the hogs overfinished before they could get them scheduled in. In our own story of this, a couple of years ago, we had our slaughter that was scheduled in, canceled a week ahead of it happening. It was caused by a labor shortage. We ended up finding another processor. It took 4 months, and we had to go across the state to get to them. That was 4 months of having to put extra feed in those cattle and not having any beef to sell at the time. The reasons for the shortage are varying and they intersect. I hear about challenges related to workforce, skilled training, compliance with regulations, facilities, generational transition. That's why I think it would make sense to give the department some resources to bring farmers, processors, educational institutions, and others together to develop some recommendations. I know a number of Farmers Union members and others who would be interested in joining for such a conversation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. We have at least one question. So Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vanderpool, welcome. I think this is a really important thing to go out there and have the discussion with these people, and so I support this. My question is, you won't hear me say this often, but is a $10,000 study, like $10,000 I assume probably covers some travel and stipend expenses would be my assumption of whoever's going to do this. But small to medium-sized meat processing issue is very big in rural Minnesota. And when you say small to medium, it's a wide range, meaning like you have the real big boys and they kind of do what they do, their integrated systems, but this does kind of fall into everyone else. It doesn't fit into that. And I know that it might be smaller and handful, but this is a real challenge out there. And I have some presumptive reasons as to why the challenges are, but the study should unfold that. I'm not here to say that right now. But I just hope that when this study is done, that we do get those answers, and I'm just not positive that a $10,000 study is going to do that. So maybe this is a good start, but I can tell you this is one of the bigger problems that we have in rural Minnesota in keeping our smaller farms and people that are looking into some of the different newer markets, you know, whether it's grazing or things like that. This is going to be a real challenge, and I hope that we can spend more time on this and get a good thorough study in the future.
Thank you. I don't know if anybody has a reaction to that, but we'll move on. I think it's a fair comment to say that, you know, $10,000, you get what you get for $10,000, but I think, as everyone's aware, it is an issue, and we do need to reach out to the farmers and find out, you know, maybe what the solutions might be as well. So, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of along the same lines, I guess, and this is a question for the author, does this bill cover poultry?
Representative Wasilek.
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it covers poultry or not. I think that's something that we could certainly include if we want to have that as part of this process.
Because I believe I heard the testifier use the word poultry. I'm just searching. I can't find the word poultry in here. And I guess then kind of a follow-on, can you tell me what meat production areas would not get special attention, since you very specifically called out one area, which apparently doesn't include poultry? Is that report going to tell us what areas they didn't give special attention to relative to meat production and processing?
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's just trying to focus on really putting a focus on the grazing aspect, because that's a piece of our continuing conversation around agriculture and addressing the climate crisis. So that doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about other folks who are doing other sorts of things, just that we want to have a focus on that, because that's a piece of what we're going to be doing with agriculture moving forward.
Representative Lewick.
Well, I would just suggest to the author that I'm not sure who grazes their farrowing sows in the winter, but probably very few people, and that is a step in the production of finishing swine, but that's not the product, and it doesn't appear that we're going to address poultry in here. The word isn't there, so I would suggest that we really need to sit down with the Department of Agriculture here and kind of redo this, because one, to very specifically, if you can't, you know, if you can start calling out one particular element and spend $10,000 on that, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I appreciate the direction you're headed here, but I think this needs a lot of work, because we're just going to spend $10,000 on a particular area. The problem that I see in where I'm at in rural Minnesota is the meat processors, period. It doesn't matter whether it's poultry, sheep, lamb, beef, swine, and it frankly has little to do with whether or not they're even able to introduce grazing into their production line. So, I just think this needs a whole lot of cleaning up, because it looks like we're going to ignore some people intentionally by the wording in this bill.
Representative Lueck, so meat processors doesn't include all of those that you just named?
Well, that does, but...
Because that is indicated in line 1.7, mm-hmm. You know, meat processors. So to me, what else? I mean, we could put in poultry as an additional word.
Well, and I say, I'm certainly no expert on swine production, but I know there's two completely separate houses for those that have spent time there, and one is a farrowing house and the other is a finishing house, and the two are completely different, totally different. It just looks to me like, frankly, I would eliminate that sentence about the special attention, and special attention should be paid to the problem of not having enough meat processors, not whether or not the product comes in there, whether it's been grazed or not, because, you know, in other words, what are we trying to solve here, a grazing issue, or are we really trying to solve a meat processor issue? Because this looks like it's going to intentionally deflect the intention of the Department of Agriculture to a very specific area that has to do with grazing, not meat processing, and I think that's the swamp we're trying to drain here. I appreciate the direction we're headed here, but I'm just trying to figure out whether this is going to be $10,000 spent on worrying about grazing as opposed to really focused directly at meat processing, because that's the shortage I see all over our part of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lueck. And to this point, Representative Lippert?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to share, Representative Lueck, and just add in the conversation, what I've been hearing from farmers is an interest in cover crops among corn and bean farmers, and also then an interest in integrating grazing with that because of the environmental benefits and economic benefits of being able to add grazing in this new way. So I think I support that line being in there. I think there's a lot of energy around that in agriculture discussions right now, and processing is an obstacle for farmers to be able to take advantage of some of these new practices and techniques. So that's what I would add to the conversation right now.
All right. And Representative Wasowick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think to Representative Miller's point, this is not the end-all, be-all of this discussion. This is us trying to kick off something and get something started. So I think there's certainly room for, and the bill does say other stakeholders, so that is trying to be inclusive of other folks who maybe aren't specifically named in this legislation. But certainly, if we wanted to add poultry in there, we could certainly do that. But again, this is $10,000. It's a start in this effort. It's not the final say that we're going to have on this issue.
Thank you. Next on the list, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to agree with Representative Lueck on this. When I saw that sentence, I thought that's a totally separate issue from slaughtering and processing. And I like your bill. And I was going to say, yeah, is $10,000 enough for this study? But $10,000 at the state level doesn't buy you a whole lot in terms of what studies cost. And it just seems to me also that adding that line does put at least part of the focus on an aspect that doesn't really pertain to slaughtering and processing. So I also question the inclusion of that line in this bill, because it's totally a separate subject from what you're trying to get at.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions right now. And are there any other testifiers in the audience? I don't see anyone else coming down. So this is a bill that will be laid over for possible inclusion. So we have time to be able to add to it or take from it if we so desire. But Representative Wasowick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the discussion and certainly open to some conversation around this. So. But I think we know we've all talked about this issue. We know that it is a concern and want to move forward with getting the information that will be helpful in making some decisions in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. So with that, this bill will be laid over. Thank you to the testifier as well. Okay, so now we're moving to House File 3991.
Madam Chair, would you like to move your bill?
I would. I'd like to move House File 3991 to be laid over for future consideration.
Okay, present the bill and introduce your witnesses.
Sure. Just FYI, this is a bill that's a straight policy bill. That's why we're hearing it today, and we are looking at making a change, a slight change to this bill. It is hopefully not going to meet with any controversy, but I do have somebody here who's going to testify about why it's being brought forward. So I'm just going to have Laura Lemke be able to speak to the issue and address why we're here.
Can you please state your name and continue with your testimony?
Good morning. My name is Laura Lemke. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent the commercial grain elevator and feed mill industry in the state. Last year, in response to the massive embezzlement situation and ultimate failure of the Ashby Farmers Co-op elevator, the legislature made changes to the grain buyer's law and licensing requirements to better protect producers. I'm here today to ask for a small change to the grain buyer law regarding oral credit contracts and credit contracts reduced to writing. Last session, we were mostly supportive of the changes the legislature made, and in fact, asked the legislature for a more restrictive time period of 10 days instead of the originally proposed 30 days, to reduce to writing an oral agreement to a voluntary extension of credit contract and get it signed by both the buyer and seller. Today, I'm asking you to change the legislation back to 30 days. Since the end of last session, several MGFA members have come forward and shared their concerns that the 10-day window is simply too restrictive and is logistically unrealistic for them. For that reason, I'm asking you to consider reverting back to the 30-day window. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any other members of the... anybody else wish to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. Ms. Lemke, could you just clear up something? I was in contact with local ethanol plant a couple of weeks back about contracting some corn and deferring the payment. And he said, well, you got to get this law changed because we can't extend credit more than 30 days. Does this have anything to do with how long credit can be extended?
Representative Anderson, I am not 100% sure on the answer to that question. This change would be just for credit contracts, and I'm not sure to answer your question. I will figure that out and get back to you.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there's some confusion, at least in that example that he said, well, you can't defer your contract payment till June or whatever. So please check on that and make sure that that doesn't affect the length of time that the credit could be extended. Thank you.
Any other questions for members? Okay, I've seen no further discussion. Chair Poppy, would you like to add any closing comments before we lay your bill over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate that Ms. Lemke is going to find more information. But at this point, if it's at 10 days, so then I don't know if Representative Anderson, if he's saying currently he can only do a 10-day contract, it seems like maybe there's some confusion about other aspects of this as well, but I think this is a request by the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, and I would ask that it be laid over, but that we consider the benefit of doing this in the future.
Okay. With that, House File 3991 is laid over. Next up is House File 4285, and I believe we'll have some members from the department come down and walk through the bill.
Okay, so what we have before us is the Minnesota Department of Ag Policy Bill. There's going to be a technical amendment that we're going to move and put on the bill, but besides that, we are not actually moving the bill at this point. So today we're going to have the walkthrough so we understand what the bill is and what the author's amendment does. Next week we will roll out a DE amendment, a delete everything amendment to consider. And then, so that will happen on Tuesday. Then on Thursday we'll actually act on our policy bill. So by next Wednesday at 9:45, that's when any amendments would be due. But we'll have the bill before us on Tuesday so people will know what's in it, be able to prepare any amendments. Then on Thursday we'll act on it. So we'll meet our timeline, which is important for us to be able to get the policy bill through. So with us today, I know that we have, I'm going to move that House File 4285 to get the bill before us. And then I'd also like to move the H4285A1 amendment. So as you'll see that in the packet. And so this is regarding grain and kind of a definition about that. So that's kind of a cleanup to what the bill has in it. So any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So with us then is Mr. Chesseth from the Department of Ag. He is going to do a walkthrough. And we also did receive the bill summary that Mr. Sullivan was able to distribute to us. So we've got that as well. And so we've got our crib notes here, and we've got our actual bill. And Mr. Chesseth is going to take us through. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Peter Chesseth. I serve as the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Just a few comments about this year's policy bill. It is very technical in nature, and I am fortunate enough to be joined here today by a whole host of subject matter experts from the department who can endeavor to answer any specific questions about it. While the bill is technical in nature, it does represent a lot of work done on the part of the department, a lot of public engagement with affected stakeholders and the people we serve. So thank you, Madam Chair, for carrying our bill, and we look forward to working with the committee as we move forward in this process. So with that, I will jump right into the walkthrough. Article 1, Sections 1 through 7 pertain to the Minnesota Screenings Act. The Minnesota Screenings Act was established to limit the spread of weed seeds in grain, seed, and screenings used to feed livestock. Current statute has a specific list of weeds that is unique and different from the weed seed listed in the Minnesota Seed Law. This language change will reference the restricted and prohibited noxious weed seed list in the Minnesota Seed Law. The intent here is to make sure both the restricted and prohibited weed seed lists are the same for both seed and screenings. This list will be better managed by the new process that we are implementing to maintain the restricted and prohibited weed seed lists in the Minnesota Seed Law. Sections 8 through 12 pertain to the initial labeler clarification. The Minnesota Seed Law establishes criteria for labeling and maintaining records regarding characteristics of seed offer for sale, such as germination rate, purity, and variety. The statute is supported through inspection and analysis of seed for sale to determine label accuracy. There are several updates needed to the seed law. For example, the current definition of initial labeler is vague enough to lead to different interpretations as to what party is responsible for the accuracy of a seed label. MDA's proposed language clarifies that anyone labeling seed is responsible for the label as the labeler. These changes will not affect how the program operates. Furthermore, the range of germination rates that are acceptable for given labeling claims are out of date and are defined in rule, making them difficult to edit as they change over time. Our proposed language change creates a reference in statute to tolerance levels which are set by the USDA. This keeps our law consistent with federal law. Section 13 pertains to prohibited and restricted seeds. Currently, the list of prohibited and restricted noxious weed seeds is maintained in rule, and there is no defined process for editing this list, making it very difficult to keep up to date. We propose to statutorily create a seed advisory committee, which would be responsible for the listing process with the final determination by the Commissioner of Agriculture. We envision a process very similar to that used by the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee. The Seed Advisory Committee would recommend to the Commissioner whether a species should be listed as prohibited noxious weed seed or restricted noxious weed seed. Species designated as prohibited or restricted would be reevaluated every 3 years for recommendation on whether the species should remain on the list. Members of the committee would also advise the commissioner on the implementation of the Minnesota seed law. Members of the committee would not be entitled to reimbursement of expenses or a per diem. Article 2, sections 1 through 17, all pertain to noxious weed and technical changes therein. The Minnesota weed law establishes a process for listing noxious weeds and a framework for detection and control within the state. The Noxious Weed Advisory Committee is defined in the statute as is the process they follow for recommending weeds to be listed. The Noxious Weed Advisory Committee, otherwise known as NWAC, has identified some technical changes to clarify language and eliminate confusing terms, particularly in the definitions of the different categories of noxious weeds, prohibited, restricted, etc. These changes will not change the way the program operates. Members of NWAC have reviewed the proposed changes and notified their constituents. There's not been any opposition to the proposed changes. Article 3 contains miscellaneous provisions. Sections 1 through 3 are technical changes to the Agriculture Best Management Loan Program. This section removes unnecessary language and clarifies terms such as borrower and local lender. There are no substantive changes to the program within these sections. Section 4 pertains to the shipment of plant pests and biological control agents. This section lays out permit requirements for the movement of live plant pests and noxious weeds. Most permitting is addressed through the USDA, but the statute prescribes a redundant state permit which is not needed and has not been used previously. The amendment clarifies when a state permit is needed and when it is not. Sections 5 through 6 update Minnesota pet rules and adopt the Association of American Feed Control's officials model pet rules, food rules. These sections align Minnesota rules with national standards and will reduce duplication of efforts for rural development. It will ease the regulatory compliance burden for the industry, as it would align Minnesota with the industry's primary regulatory reference for pet food label development. It will provide modern and consistent pet food labeling for Minnesota customers. Section 7 just clarifies the definition of custom processor. Section 8 is pertaining to egg temperature storage, and that would change the temperature eggs must be held at from 41 degrees to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. There are no public health risks associated with this change. Sections 9 through 11 pertain to venison processing. This proposal adds wild game and fowl to the definition of animals covered under the custom exempt meat processing and amends associated statutes to ensure constituency and all other exceptions and exemptions are maintained. This statutory change will override the provisions of the Minnesota Food Code that require variances for specialized processes, which includes wild game processing. It will create an equal playing field for venison processors, those who have retail operations and those that do not. And finally, Section 12 pertains to the disaster recovery loan program through our RFA. This section removes language in order to provide the RFA board and the Commissioner of Agriculture more flexibility when determining what event constitutes a disaster. For example, it deletes a specific reference to highly pathogenic avian influenza and replaces it with highly contagious disease. These changes will enable the RFA to respond more quickly in times of disaster. And that, Madam Chair and members, is a brief walkthrough of our technical policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chesset. As everyone is digesting it, we may not have a lot of questions right away, but we do have at least one. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of curious, 41 to 45 degrees, could you enlighten us a little bit to why the change in the 4 degrees for eggs?
Mr. Chesset.
Madam Chair, Representative Brand, I cannot, but luckily I have a subject matter expert in the audience. Dr. Nicole Kneeser can come and explain why the 4 degree difference.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Kneeser.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. That change is being made to reflect the change that was made in the Retail Food Code recently. And so we're just trying to make the statute align with the Retail Food Code. So it used to be that eggs at wholesale were 45 and retail were 41, and now eggs at wholesale can be 45 and retail can also be 45, which makes things much more streamlined and more consistent with other states as well.
All right, Representative Brand.
But why the 4 degrees? I mean, is it a matter of saving energy, or do we know that eggs don't spoil at 45 like we used to think that they would spoil if they were above 41? Why are we changing the temperatures over the last couple of years?
Dr. Kneeser.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't believe that there's any scientific reason that we chose 41 over 45 to begin with. The science shows that 45 is a safe temperature to hold eggs at. I believe that historically the concern that eggs were held at 41 was due to probably retail holding conditions, the length of time on the shelf and those kinds of things. And so 41 was sort of believed to be a safer temperature perhaps, but 45 is scientifically proven to be a safe temperature to hold eggs as well.
Thank you. Representative Waslowick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Section 12, talking about the disaster recovery loan program, and I understand kind of the reasoning behind eliminating specific things from that first article there, but I'm just wondering if that, I don't know how the process works, so I'm wondering if you could elaborate on, you know, now that we're taking these things out, what are the criteria going to be for what a disaster is?
Mr. Chesset.
Madam Chair, Representative. So if we would eliminate the specific reference to certain events, what that would enable is the RFA board, in conjunction with the commissioner, could act more quickly. Say there's an event that we have not identified yet, or a contagious disease, or you know some weather event that wasn't specifically listed in the statute. The board, along with the commissioner, could get together even over the phone and declare that a disaster and open up those loan funds for individuals affected by that particular event that wasn't listed in statute. Whereas if it fell outside the realm of one of those listed events, there would be some confusion as to whether or not the board or the commissioner could take that action to declare it a disaster.
Thank you. I'm going to just follow up on that one because last year we did this, and made the change. Now we're reverting to what we used to have, and the reason why we made the change is because we didn't think RFA had the ability to react when the barns were collapsing due to snow. So was there I guess I'm a bit confused. I think this is a reverting back to what was originally in statute, kind of, or Mr. Chesseth?
Madam Chair, I'd say kind of is probably right. I believe last session we added more specific events that would qualify. And then this year we're scaling back on listing out those specific events and trying to make the language a little more flexible for the board and the commissioner. So I don't think all of the events that we added last year were previously in statute. Perhaps Mr. Sullivan could.
Would you like to add to this discussion, Mr. Sullivan?
Madam Chair and members, what Mr. Chesseth has said is consistent with my memory of what happened last year as well. I think the statute coming into last session allowed loans for high wind, hail, tornado, or flood. And I think the department recommended and the House agreed that the language should be broadened to allow the authority to determine when a disaster has occurred. And I think in negotiations with the Senate, the final result was simply to add the weight of snow, sleet, or ice on 25.26. So that would be deleted along with the different types of natural disasters that were listed in statute previously.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. So are we still allowing the authority to make that determination? Or have we made a change with that? I don't know if Mr. Chesseth.
Madam Chair, that is my understanding, is that we still allowing the authority to make that determination and consult in consultation with the Commissioner of Agriculture. But I can certainly double check and get that back to you and the committee.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Anderson? Representative Wasilewicz, you were done, right? Correct. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the section 5 on page 2, line 20, adding the word prohibited noxious weed seed. Are we saying that until this is passed, it's lawful to sell grain containing prohibited noxious weeds?
Mr. Chesseth.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I am going to again call upon one of my subject matter experts to help clarify that.
And Representative Anderson, you were looking at line 20. Is that where you are? Yes, okay. So 2.20. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name first, and then we can repeat the question if you didn't hear it.
My name is Denise Thede, and I'm a section manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Right, and it was on page 2, line 20, so section 5. And Representative Anderson, if you want to repeat your question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. But we're adding those words prohibited noxious weed seeds. So currently, is it lawful to sell grain containing prohibited seeds?
Yes.
To the test fire.
It currently is. So this applies to grain weed infested grain, which and also screenings. And currently, those products can be sold if they contain prohibited. Well, there are no prohibited weeds under the current Screenings Act.
Ms. Representative Anderson.
The sale is prohibited if the restricted weeds exceed 10% or more than 90 of the weeds that are currently listed in statute, 90 per pound. Those are the only restrictions.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I guess what I'm thinking about is Palmer amaranth seed, which is, yeah, I believe, is prohibited. So for CRP seed coming, you're talking about a different thing than seeding CRP acres, I assume.
Right, so we have two laws. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. And it was Deed, was that your last name?
Feed.
Seed?
Oh, We have two laws that apply.
Okay.
So under the seed law, we do have prohibited and restricted weeds listed, and Palmer amaranth was added by emergency order to our prohibited list. So it is not legal to sell seed containing Palmer amaranth. Unfortunately, though, our screenings law currently does not track with our seed law, and that's why we're proposing these changes, so that the prohibited and restricted lists match both in the screenings law and in the seed law. And in Minnesota, we did have screenings that did contain Palmer amaranth, and technically, under the Screenings Act, that would not have been an illegal product.
Thank you.
One.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that explanation. My last question for Mr. Chesa, and it goes back to the amendment that we just adopted. And a couple of times during your presentation, you talked about kind of aligning with USDA standards, yet the amendment kind of goes the opposite way. You're getting very prescriptive in the naming specific crops or grains and going away from the USDA standard. Why?
Mr. Chesa.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, again, I'm going to call on a subject matter expert to talk about that, but I know it has something to do with making sure that folks that believe it has something to do with the elevator failures that we had and some of the farmers that had specific grains that weren't part of the definition. But I should probably stop talking and let my subject matter expert.
Well, welcome to the committee, and just state your name. Please.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Milanowski. I am a section manager with the Plant Protection Department. The section I manage is the Fruit, Vegetable, and Grain Program. Mr. Chesseth is correct. It does have to do with some of the failures that we saw in Minnesota over the last couple of years, specifically a failure out of Wadena, Buckwheat Growers Association. We had several claims that came in that we had to reject for grain that wasn't specifically defined in our statute. In this amendment, we have included one final note. It's in that last line that basically says, and other products typically stored by grain warehouses. That would allow us to leave the door open for some new emerging products. One of those would be hemp seed sold for CBD processing.
All right. I think that answers that question. Thank you for that clarification. And Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to go back to page 25 and line 25.22. And I'm disturbed by the fact that disaster isn't qualified in any way, shape, or form. And so I was just looking at the U.S., the National Farmers Disaster Assistance, and it qualifies the word disaster with natural. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't also qualify it with the word natural disaster, which would then take in the elements. But I wonder if our researcher, Mr. Sullivan, if you could help me out there. Is there a definition for the word disaster?
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Cleavorn, I grabbed the statute book to look at the entirety of the statute, 41B.047. I don't see a definition. I'm just sort of skimming the statute right now, and I don't see the word natural modifying disaster in the statute. It's possible I'm missing it as I scan it here, but I think you're correct that disaster is an undefined term for purposes of this statute and program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn.
I would just like for us, as we're going forward with this bill, to think about that in a broader sense, and maybe we would do something in the DE amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It does seem to change things back or do something that, I mean, we urgently did this last year and wanted to take care of something, and I don't want us to have to urgently do it again next winter. So if we can try to reduce that possibility. That would be good. Anybody else had a question from the committee? I don't see any other questions. Are there any other comments that, Mr. Chesseth, you'd like to be able to make regarding this very technical bill?
Madam Chair, members, I just want to, again, thank you for carrying it and reiterate that the department is always willing and eager to work with anyone that has questions or suggestions on how to improve this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chesseth. And just to open it up to anyone in the audience, if they wanted to comment on what they heard this morning with this bill, I don't see anyone coming forward to do that. And this is just a reminder, this will be the vehicle bill for us, so we will be making adjustments to this bill, and that will be happening so that people will know what we're looking at next Tuesday when we bring this bill before us again. But I appreciate the comments and the suggestions and the considerations. So I don't think there's anything that needs to come before us today. So with that, meeting will be adjourned.